like to call the meeting of Tuesday, February the 9th, 2021 to order. Please be reminded that this meeting is being audioed and videoed, and if you have any phones with you, please ensure they are on mute. Are there any changes or approval to the agenda? If not, I ask for a mover. Moved by Councilor Romero, seconded by Councilor Fancy, that the agenda be approved. All those in favor? RCMP, do we know where Staff Sergeant Daniel Archibald is? We will check in to Staff Sergeant Archibald. Presentation, Queens Daycare Association. Who is making that presentation? Do we just defer those and move on? Are there any petitions to table? Not. Public question comment session. I remind everyone to state your name and your civic address before commencing. Are there any public questions or comments session?
Leon Robertson, Police Chief in Liverpool. Not on the agenda here, but in reading the RCMP report, there's a reference to the number of times they had to go to Carter's Beach last year. And I was just wondering, as I remember, the previous council had set up a committee, and with the, I think it was Council Hughes, and also with a provincial person on, and people from the area there, to see how they can rectify the situation, because there was quite a situation there last year with respect to parking and so on. Perhaps the CEO can bring us up to date on the status of that committee.
Not aware of any committee other than the provincial committee, and so council are not involved with that committee and not privy to their discussion. So, with Deputy Mayor Hughes would have to be one to respond to that.
Yeah, I was hoping that he'd be here. Probably would be able to give us an update. Thank you.
And Deputy Mews did send his regrets.
Pardon?
Deputy Mews sent his regrets today. Any other public questions or comments?
Good morning. I'm the secretary of the daycare board.
And civic address?
Civic address. 132 Water Route.
Thanks, Carol.
I know Scott is busy working, and so probably that's why he's not here yet. So I can't really comment on his presentation, but I can comment on having been associated with daycare for many, many years. And I have two grandmothers on board. And it's a really exciting time at the daycare because we have so many young professionals that have come on our board. I know people in so many groups are having trouble attracting qualified, educated, young, vibrant people. We have challenges from the board hasn't even moved to Liverpool yet, coming in anticipation of coming to a well-organized and dedicated daycare. We have people that have just moved recently who have brought their children. Because with the influx of people, they don't have grandparents and families and neighbors to look after their children. So one of the things they're looking for when they're looking to come to Queens is where are you going to find qualified lessons? So we have an answer. We're lucky we're ahead of the game because here in Queens we've had that qualification. But we also have to look at the fact that many people can't an extended maternity leave, so where are they going to put their children? So that's why we've finally attracted one of the reasons we have an infant care center here. Been able to be successful other than for the government, and everyone knows here how we're hearing child care on the news and broadcast and how important it is. And most people, unless you're involved with the day, so do not realize how many restrictions, how many licensing requirements there are, how much red tape and everything's involved. Be sure that our children are safe. And we have a staff that, when they come, they really want to go. They have to go for financial reasons sometimes because the school system not as incorporated part of our program. early because they want to leave their kids there, but summer's off and all the patients and requirements and pay. But we're left holding court open for people whose children aren't. So if we don't have our card, you know, who's gonna pick up that slack? Who's gonna pick up the fact that these children are identified early that they need extra help? And so there's a lot of things to consider. Take care of this community. I'm not from here, but I've been here since 1980. And I've been involved with women and children since I came to Raleigh. And we've gone to the daycare. And the staff there is fabulous. If you want to go there and spend the day, I'm sure anybody's had a spot to see. They love having board. But trust me, it's a busy place. Kids are great, the staff is great, and finances we just can't come up with. So very important that we have somebody here on our side. Council has supported us so much in the past. We were used to that support when we didn't have to pay rent or look after a building. And so I think if we could get council support back on track, it's not a new direction for council to help the daycare. It just went by the wayside for a lot of different reasons. And I think it's now we can't get back on track and.
Thank you, Kara. Staff Sergeant Daniel Archibald.
Hello.
Come for Heather.
Heather.
We've received your council report. Are there any additions or explanations you would like to add to this?
It's pretty straightforward. It's more of an informative thing for us. Our fiscal year, of course, runs April 1st onward to March 31st. So we're approaching the end of our fiscal year and how we gauge statistics and what type of year it's been. Every year we like to do performance planning. That comes from, in large part, from our headquarters for the division in Dartmouth and kind of works its way down where we take initiatives and we try to reach those goals. Like, so every year, it's like since I've been here, it's been road safety, crime prevention, cyber crime, and increased relations with First Nations. There are talks that's going to be changing this year with new initiatives, but at the same time, my job is to speak to you folks here from the municipality, determine what your priorities could be to fit in line with these priorities that come down from the division. And most times, it's often traffic issues and enforcement, road safety, right? So we're able to coincide those initiatives. So I'll be hearing, hopefully, from our headquarters department in the next couple of months. But as far as how this past year went, it being a COVID year, our numbers were surprisingly well. I could talk about that a bit more if you like, and just get into it. We've included some information of interest, some things we've been doing throughout the year. I spoke with them at previous meetings, but there's been a turnover here, so I don't have to take up much of your time. It's all here. You can have a look at some things we've been doing. We have been using we use units out of headquarters that come in and help us. Our integrated child exploitation unit has been down numerous times, which has been a great benefit in enforcing those types of child exploitation charges. We work closely with them. A large part of our year two has also been Quarantine Act checks and files that has kept us busy with new folks coming into the country. Is when we would get one of those Quarantine Act files activated, and we'd do a door knock and a compliance check. So it's been a different year in regards to those type of files. For road safety, I could talk about numbers if a bit if you guys would like. It's all listed here, but so our number of tickets are usually around anywhere from 300 to 400. This year has been a good year for tickets. We're doing we're at 350 already, so we still got 2 months left, so we'll be probably well above 400, which is a significant increase from years prior. Check stops is something we want to keep doing and enforcing, so I like to see an increase in those in the upcoming year. So we're out there on the road enforcing Motor Vehicle Act tickets. Crime reduction, of course, at this, we've conducted over 350 curfew checks this year. We do have offenders residing in our area who are on court ordered curfews. We continue to bang on those doors as well, just to ensure everyone's keeping honest and abiding by their conditions. So that's something we're going to continue to do. Calls for service, as of last week, we're at 2,122 instances that were reported through us. And anytime someone calls our dispatch center, a file is open and we have to investigate it. This also includes our proactive files and tickets that'll count as a generated number. So there's just a bit of a breakdown there to I can get way more detailed in the breakdown, but I've been told you folks don't really feel it's necessary. So I've just kind of broke it down the way I did, so you can have a general overall view of what type of calls are coming in. So back to those Quarantine Act calls for service. So since COVID, since March, since the outbreak, we've had over 153 different types of, whether it's health protection, emergency management, or Quarantine Act. And we've charged 23 people for not abiding by those regulations. And a lot of those could be social distancing, masks, and the Quarantine Act. If someone's not home abiding, then and I think there was actually one party they had at New Year's there, which we had to break up, which one ticket was late as well for that. But that's the year in a quick blur. Nothing real significant to add to that, unless you folks want me to get more detail. I know you, the parking lot's full out there.
That's fine. Are there any questions of Staff Sergeant Archibald while he's here? Councillor Brown and then Councillor Fancy.
I've been getting quite a few calls lately from people questioning our municipal noise bylaws. And one of the things that they've been saying is they've been told by officers who appear that our bylaw is hard to enforce. Is that a true indication of what you're facing?
Yes, well, we're like, the RCMP, we're not bylaw officers.
Right.
Per se, so we have ways to try and enforce it. I think it would be difficult in certain ways. Primarily what we deal with is criminal code aspects.
Right.
To lay a criminal code charge for a loud noise would be difficult for us.
Right.
Especially when it goes through provincial crown prosecutions, it can be difficult. We do try and uphold those bylaws as best as can, but oftentimes people know what time the bylaw starts, so some people can be silly with it, unfortunately, and it gets difficult. There have been situations where when push comes to shove, yeah, it's been challenging for us to enforce those things. But I hope that answers your question.
I think so. So if we had better written rules, would it make it easier for you?
I mean, it's hard to say. Possibly.
Yeah.
Again, these are. We do like to help out with the bylaws whenever we can, and if there was something, depending on what situation you're talking about, of course, if it was perhaps laid out in a more specific term that could help these individuals who are calling, then yeah.
Right. Okay.
Could very well.
Yeah, it's mostly in one area out in North in the LaBelle area.
Yep.
So I think you're probably.
Oh, that would be very.
Yeah.
Very
so so that would probably be more of a harassment. Or something like that.
Yeah, there's a lot to that one.
Okay. All right, thank you.
No problem.
Councillor Fancy.
Yeah, the one thing that comes up to me, and I don't know which way it falls under. I'm just trying to think of that under. But under, I don't know if it's under harassment or fraud, but a lot of people are still getting a lot of phone calls and a lot of older people are getting sucked into scams and things. Is that fall under any of these, or have you charged people with? Have you actually caught people doing these things?
When it comes to phone calls, like the CRA one that's calling, yeah. I've gotten three this past week on my personal
yeah.
cell. Those can be reported through the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes they're referred directly to them. They're based out of Ottawa, and they take an abundance of the information, and they do, they conduct investigations because it is beyond us. They do come out, the anti-fraud center with charges, like high-profile ones, from the collection of that data. So it does probably seem as if your phone call to them means nothing, but it is just a collection of data, and they compile that as best they can to enforce those things. So sometimes people do get caught doing that frequently, actually, but on a local level, a lot of times, no, it's beyond us. It's much further scope than what we get into or have time for, so.
Okay, so where do we call?
The Canadian Anti-Fraud Center. I don't have the number, but if you Google it, it's a branch of the RCMP, and it's a 1-800 number. You can call and report that, but oftentimes it comes up as a local number, right? But that's information you give to them, and they'd be able to follow through.
Yeah, thank you.
I have just one question. After you formed the focus group for the young people sharing intimate pictures, did you see a decrease in that activity among young people?
No, I would say no. No, we're still receiving those types of complaints, and unfortunately, it still takes place. You know, I'd like to think that long term, hopefully, we're not going to give up on that. We're still, our community policing officer is still in the school every day. And preaching that, right? It's hard to get through to the young kids when they think it's innocent enough, and it's very challenging. But I think hopefully as things happen from an enforcement perspective, it'll weigh people not to do it any further, because there are consequences that come from it that could be long-lasting and affect your life going forward, right?
So what is the enforcement? For example, if a young girl or a young boy shares intimate pictures of themselves, are they chargeable for doing that themselves?
They could be, depending on the circumstances, yes. If you're a minor and you're contributing images of yourself, yeah, you could be charged, especially if it's widespread. And if that image is shared again without that person's consent, then that other, you know, it's a domino effect, right? So, yeah.
Any other? Not? I thank you. How did the weather fare? Many road accidents this weekend?
Actually, surprisingly, no. I don't think we had a single accident going forward. Just update you, everyone as well. Our traffic radar is getting repaired still. It's been a very difficult process, but it should be here within the month or so. So I'm anxiously awaiting that, as we probably all are, and we've seen the benefits from it. That's it. That's all.
Thanks.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Scott, you're up next.
That's not it. Must be back that one.
There. All right. Well, thanks, everyone.
Mr. CAO and counselors and all you folks. Thanks for being here today, giving us the opportunity to talk about Queens Daycare Association. I understand that we don't have a lot of time, so this is a succinct presentation of a rather complex scenario, but my intention is just to provide you folks with a bit of background information about what the Queens Daycare Association is up to, the sort of financial predicament that we find ourselves in, some of the factors that have led us to our current state, some of the pressures that we are facing now and we're going to face into the future, and providing you with a bit of an idea of what the potential sort of path forward for the daycare could look like, and then hopefully leave enough time for some conversations and questions. I apologize, I wasn't able to get here right for 9. Carol, who's a member of the Daycare Association with me, said that she was able to speak in support of the daycare. I apologize that I wasn't here for those remarks. Maybe we can build off of that as we go. I'm not sure in sort of the decorum, but I feel free to, you know, if you have a burning question as we move through it or something isn't clear in my presentation, I'm not someone who's like easily shaken by being interrupted as I go through this. So if there is something that you think is germane and makes sense to talk about as we move through, then please don't hesitate to let me know. But without further ado, here we go. So just a little bit of background, and I let you folks have the information there in the printed version. But who we are? So we are the sole sole provider of licensed childcare facilities in the community. And the reason that's so important is that without a license, if you're not a licensed childcare facility, you're not eligible for subsidies. So the subsidies that are provided to low-income families for childcare through the Department of Community and Social Services are only issued when that child is attending a licensed childcare facility, provincially licensed. We're an employer of 7 full-time early childhood educators and then a pool of part-time staff as required. We're also proud to say that we're a charitable organization. It's a very arduous process, but we successfully obtained our charitable status as of 2020, and I think it's timely, and hopefully is part of our solution moving forward, because as you'll see, I'm going to share that we really do require the support of a lot of different avenues, and having their charitable status is one step in the right direction, because we can issue tax receipts as a result of that. So what we do is we provide fully inclusive, affordable, accessible child care and development services for children between the ages of 18 months and 12 years old. And you'll see there, it's not, we're babysitters. The early childhood educators are not babysitters. They are held to a standard of programming and of early childhood development that is above and beyond just a child-minding service. This is the first opportunity for children to be in a structured social environment and to learn through play in those crucial years. So currently, we can only provide care for children 18 months and older. That's a result of the licensing, and our current facility is not appropriate for children under the age of 18 months. That's a big gap. It's a gap that's identified and is a strategic priority for the provincial government in terms of expanding accessible, affordable, licensed child care for children under the ages of 18 months. So we are in the process of expanding our services to meet those community needs. It's an identified need in the community. We've heard from lots of parents. I'm one parent who would take advantage of infant care. I have a 9-month-old baby now who I hope can be enrolled in the infant care program. And my son, who's now 4, when we moved here when he was 10 months of age, and we really found ourselves in a very difficult situation trying to find childcare service for Lachlan when I had to return to work. And we were just fortunate that our then neighbor ended up taking him. And then I think, just to speak to what we do, the change that I noticed in my son Lachlan when he was exposed, like I said, we were very fortunate that my neighbor was able to take him, and it was a loving environment. the developmental opportunities that the licensed daycare and interacting with his peer groups did. And it's very important that children of that age have the opportunity to interact in a group care atmosphere. And then the other piece that we're looking at expanding is extended hours care. We've heard from, particularly from the hospital and the hospital foundation, the importance of expanding our hours of operation from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. shift. We currently only have, we're only open for 10 hours a day, which isn't suitable for a lot of people who work shift work or non-traditional working hours. And we believe that both the infant care facility and the extended hours care, expanding our programming to meet those two community needs, will be a big part of the future of this organization in terms of solvency and in terms of attracting and retaining enrollment of young children. We know that if you're in a position where you need to find childcare when you're looking at returning to work, whatever is 6, 8, 10, 12 months after the birth of that child, and you find a suitable arrangement, you're not going to take the child out of that facility or out of that situation just because they've hit 18 months and are now eligible to go to the Queen's daycare. So we're missing out on a wave of, and typically what happens is those cohorts, they'll move through with a lot with continuity and they'll stay in the childcare setting that they started right up to the point that they're of age to go to school. So we think that that's really important to capture that group and as well as the extended hours. And it's not just the hospital. Folks who work at Michelin, folks who work at Aqualitas, folks who work in, you know, any setting where you really don't work that typical 8 to 4, 9 to 5 type situation, you need other types of care. You'll see that that says pending an Economic Social Development Canada grant because we are in a very difficult financial situation and we're not in a position to take on anything that would further our operational deficit. So that is pending a grant that we put to the Economic Social Development Canada, should hear back by next month. And what we've asked there is for 24 months of incubation funding so that we can expand our hours, expand our staffing, and accommodate a warm meal in the evening but we'll be insulated against the financial impact of that through this funding if we're successful in obtaining that funding. So the challenges we face, a massive challenge that sort of all, and it's not unique to the Queen's Daycare Association, it's been felt by all licensed daycare facilities operating in rural Nova Scotia, was the introduction of the pre-primary program. And that was rolled out in our area, in the South Shore region, the Regional Center for Education, in September of 2018. And what that meant was that children who were the year before they were going to primary school, to grade primary, so whether they were 4 or 5, that year, it took them out of the revenue stream for nonprofit daycares. It took that whole cohort of students. So as I've said, we provide care for children from 18 months to 12 years, but the 12 years, the 5 to 12 is just for sort of summer programming and after school care. Our real sort of core operations is that 18 month to the time that they go to school. The time that they go to school became abbreviated by a year, became shortened by a year, where there's a whole, and that's further problematic because those are our money-making years. Infant care and toddler care requires much more staffing and is much more resource intensive to provide that, and is to be honest, it's impossible to run a daycare operation with just infants and toddlers without it being a loss. Where you make your money in this model, or where you make back your money that you've lost on the younger years, is those children who are over the age of 3, between 3 and 5. So with the introduction of the pre-primary program, they took out about 40% of our profits right there. The other thing is that it was very disruptive to an already thin labor pool in rural Nova Scotia around qualified ECEs. These early childhood educators are either they've gone through a certificate program or they're college or university educated. It's a specialized skill set. So we only have so many, and really the most experienced, most skilled early childhood educators, they went to the pre-primary program. Better salary, better everything. They get their summers off. They it's more stability than working for a nonprofit. we really can't compete. And I'm not sure if any of you folks have become aware of, there's a lot of talk about that in the media as of late, about addressing the discrepancy between the working conditions, the compensation for early childhood educators working in the nonprofit daycare sector, and those working in the pre-primary program. So it is very topical. And anyway, the introduction of the pre-primary program, it caused us to lose a lot of our staff. I mean, just this year, we actually got, we were actually hit with a violation against our licensing because we couldn't backfill a position quick enough because our level two early childhood educator, who was part of our management team, was in charge of some of our programming, left to work in Caledonia at the pre-primary program. So it has really impacted our enrollment numbers, and it's really impacted our staffing complement. And then the other piece that's really contributed to as a challenge is our ownership of the Mount Pleasant School. I know that several of you were on the previous council who were part of the transitioning away from ownership of the Mount Pleasant School. But since we've taken possession of the school, we spent in excess of $70,000 in necessary maintenance, and we have a lot of costs coming down the pipeline too. The septic needs to be replaced or hooked into the sewer. The furnace and oil tank are reaching end of life. There are a lot of costs with that. And to the credit of the historically of this council, this municipal group, we were operating with pretty low rent. So now being the owners of that building as opposed to low rent tenants in that building has led to a huge increase in our operational overhead associated with running this. And then we also are again in the process of responding to that, the critical need for infant care in our community. We had years ago successfully obtained $250,000 in funding from the province to open an infant care facility. The price tag on that project is expected to be around $390,000 at this point. We knew it was going to be more than $250,000. We thought it was going to be closer to $300,000, not $390,000. One major thing that we didn't expect was the cost of modifying the plans and the building so that we could run a sprinkler system off of the well, because we're not on we're not on sewer and the pressurized water out there, and that was $55,000 of unexpected costs just associated with modifications we needed to make to the sprinkler system. So with pre-primary and with the ownership of the building and with the infant care going overboard to where we thought we were going to be, we were in a very difficult situation, and our savings were being depleted at an alarming rate, and then the impact of the COVID hit, which really reduced our revenue and our ability to expand enrollment, and has still been challenging to get our enrollment numbers back up. And there were also increased costs associated with reopening after the mandatory closure. We needed to replace a number of windows so there could be proper ventilation in the rooms. There's enhanced cleaning protocols put in place, and then cohort separation to align to the standards that were issued by public health meant that we needed to, we couldn't have blending of the children from room to room or the early childhood educators from room to room. So it also increased our operating costs in terms of payroll. We've taken strides both through accessing the wage subsidy emergency wage subsidy program, and it just had to loosen our accommodations that we're making within a COVID realm, just calculated risk where we think the numbers are really low. Haven't seen any community spread out here, so we're operating more like we were prior to COVID. A very challenging situation was made impossible by the impact of COVID, and it accelerated the depletion of our savings. And all of this discussion is on the backdrop of what is insufficient provincial funding. The funding wasn't adjusted with the introduction of the pre-primary program. There were no adjustments to funding or standards or the obligations and regulations that were imposed. So upon the daycare sector. So we still needed to continue to operate with the same expectations around staffing and around cohorts in terms of the number of children, the ratios of children to staff and what was no adjustments made to accommodate for the fact that we were losing a bit, that whole year of potential revenue and enrollment. So the harsh reality is that the daycare will not be able to remain open without financial support from alternative avenues. To this point, it's been largely the provincial funding and childcare and parent fees, the childcare revenue, that has pushed this along. But as I've said, with the additional costs of, with the depleted revenue associated with the pre-primary program and the additional costs associated with owning the building, we can't continue to go on, and it's a moving target. We did get that funding from the feds in terms of the wage subsidy, the emergency wage subsidy. That's helped us stay open for another 3, 4, 5 months. It was looking like we were gonna be at threat of closing as early as March, April this year. Now it looks like we can continue on through the summer, but not much further if we can't figure out other avenues for revenue. The infant care facility construction project still requires an additional $130,000 to get that to the finish line. $130,000 that we don't currently have. And as I said, the system is systemically underfunded. And just to paint the picture, we did an in-depth cash flow projection analysis. And with our current funding levels from the provincial government and the known sort of operational costs, where this is the sort of position that we find ourselves in, and it is sort of enrollment dependent. 25, as you'll see, so enrollment is the top the line of the table there, and then the net loss per year on the bottom. So with 25 kids on like in the big side, the existing side, and then 8 infants. So if when the infant care facility is open, we will run an annual deficit of, you know, over $71,000. If our enrollment goes up to 35 kids and the 8 infants, and we are pretty certain that we will, for the most part, have full enrollment on the infant care side, we are over $52,000 as an operational deficit per annum. And then if we do get to full capacity, just to show you the inadequacies of the provincial funding, even if we have a full host, 42 on the big side and 8 infants, we're still almost $5,000 shy each year. But that $5,000, we are confident. I mean, we could take advantage of the community investment fund through this council and through community-based fundraising and probably be okay if we get to full enrollment. But we can't say with any certainty that we're gonna be at full enrollment in the next 24 to 36 months. We are hopeful that we will get there eventually, but not immediately. So what's at stake here? If the daycare closes, it will have certain detrimental impact economically on the region. Our ability to attract and retain young professionals with young families will be severely compromised if we do not have a licensed daycare facility. My wife and I, when we were relocated here 3.5 years ago, she could choose 3 different communities because Scotiabank was relocating us, and that was one of the major considerations, was what's the availability of licensed childcare in the community. We've heard from, we've worked extensively now with Al Doucette and the Hospital Foundation, and they are adamant that they need to have these services. Al's told me that the hospital currently has 30 plus healthcare employees working there who are of childbearing age, and he worries that with the closure of this facility, retaining those professionals will be a challenge. And I know personally a couple who left the community, and that was one major consideration for them was the availability of childcare, and they both worked at the hospital. I think young families are going to be a big part of the economic engine to drive the future of this community. We need to attract and retain new young families, and we need to have a licensed childcare facility as part of that picture. And so that's kind of the future, what's at stake. But in the present, what's at stake is that many of the families who rely on our services, they need subsidized childcare. They cannot afford to pay full price for childcare if they can find it. And honestly, if they can find it is a big if. There's not very many folks continuing to provide childcare. as a, just going back to the introduction of pre-primary, the introduction of pre-primary, they dropped like flies. People running licensed childcare facilities, for-profit day homes, things like that, they got out of the game because they realized that the pre-primary program like severely depleted the ability of them to run a sustainable business. And so we've seen sort of a max exodus of providers. So affordability is one thing, but then capacity and availability is another thing. Without our facility, this is what keeps me up at night, trying to fight to keep this thing open. The idea of the 15 to 20 vulnerable kids who attend our daycare on a regular full-time basis. This is, for some of these kids, the most nutritious meal that they receive in their lives. It's the most positive, structured social environment that they have access to. I'm up there all the time. I see a number of children who are reluctant to leave the comforts and the structure of the daycare setting and return to their parent or guardian at the end of the day. It is vital that we keep this open for the most vulnerable kids in our community, and I can't stress that enough. Everyone tells me that the selling point on this is the economic development impact, but for me, the selling point on this is the impact on the vulnerable children in our community now. And I can't belabor that point too much. So it's an all-hands-on-deck solution. I've met with our local MLA, Kim Maslin. She's very supportive in principle, and she is pursuing conversations with the critic in the PC caucus, the critic on education and early childhood development. The NDP critic on education and early childhood development has been loud and saying all the right things, as far as I can see, about how bad this situation is. It really, and the Progressive Conservative caucus in opposition when they tabled the legislation to create the pre-primary program, and I've gone back and looked at it, there was a lot of pushback and a lot of reservation about what is this going to do to the nonprofit daycare sector? This is going to kill the nonprofit daycare sector, and then what? The amount of money that's gone into the construction of the pre-primary program, a lot of that funding too was siphoned away from the funding avenues for the nonprofit daycare sector. And so I think a big part of this has to be lobbying for and advocating for a review and a renewal of the approach to funding nonprofit daycares in the province. But that's not happening now, but we're gonna push and push and push to make sure that is a big talking point. Try to make it an election issue whenever an election's called provincially. But private donors are interested, and we're in talks with them. They do want to see public support. They want to see the province step up. They want to see the Fed step up. They want to see the local municipality step up and be part of this. It's really challenging. It's really important. To this point, this daycare has existed on the backs of overworked volunteers, and that's going to persist because I work with our daycare association is backed by a board of very, very passionate people committed to ensuring that this continues. But it is an all hands on deck approach that we need to explore here. We are taking advantage of COVID relief programs. We're doing grant applications everywhere we can find a grant to apply to. We're doing it, and I'm spending 10 to 15 hours taking away from my business per week to try to keep this thing going. We are exploring and trying to expand our community-based fundraising activities. We ran a 50-50 draw over Christmas, which generated almost $2,000. We're just trying to do everything and anything that we can. And we do believe we're working toward a position of financial solvency by lobbying for more appropriate funding levels and then working toward full capacity of enrollment. So back to that. To the $5,000 in the hole, not $70,000 in the hole per annum. I'm trying to get to that position by 2023. We think that it's realistic with the addition of the infant care facility and the extended hours program and just the direction that the community seems to be going with so many new people moving here. We know the dam project's gonna bring in some new families. Noakalitas is looking at hiring new folks. So we do feel that there's a lot of promise to get us toward full capacity and full enrollment. But in terms of the ask, as I said, we need $130,000 to get the capital project for infant care facility over the finish line, and we need some long-term ongoing support. So the ask is, we sort of presented to you folks today, is some immediate financial assistance to the tune of $50,000 and some ongoing support to roughly around $30,000 per year for the next 36 months, but also partnership. And I can't stress that enough, the partnership that we want to create, we want Queens Daycare Association to work side by side with this council. The previous relationship between the Queens Daycare Association and the previous council, it was toxic, to be honest. And I wasn't here for the history of how that came to be, but it wasn't one of collaboration. And I think that this is a vital service. It's I challenge you to find a charitable organization functioning in our community that serves as vital and essential role in providing services to the community as the Queens Daycare Association does. So we're open and happy to build those collaborative relationships and work side by side with you folks, so that part of the welcome package, you know, when new families come here is, oh, in the Queens Daycare Association, part of the, you know, so that we can, I just think there's tons of opportunities to scratch each other's backs, and we're looking at establishing a good partnership with the high school, because they're our neighbor, and we've established a good relationship with some of those big donors and the hospital foundation. And so we're just building all of these bridges, and we also want to build a good collaborative two-way bridge with the council. So I know obviously the 50 grand and then 30 by 3 is the thing that that's, you know, the cash money is always the tricky part and the sticky part, but I also want to emphasize our willingness and our interest in engaging with this, with the municipality in a collaborative fashion moving forward.
Thank you, Scott. That was an excellent presentation.
I'm sure I would.
And I'm sure there's questions or food for thought while Scott is here.
Scott, what is your enrollment now?
Pardon?
What is your enrollment now?
I'm the chair.
What kind of numbers are we looking at?
Oh, what's my role? What's our enrollment?
Yes.
Is around 25. That 25 is kind of it fluctuates. And when I say 25, I mean 25 sort of full-time equivalency. Because sometimes we might have 33 kids there, but like in terms of as a wash, on average, we have about 25 units of $32 is the way I'm starting to.
Okay.
So around 25 right now. Yeah. And just this year, we had 8 full-time enrollees leave to the pre-primary program in September.
Councilor Brown.
Having a lower number of early childhood educators a deterrent now for getting your enrollments up?
No, I mean we have to carry the number of early childhood educators that we have to carry. We've been very supportive. We bring in entry level staff, and we basically the daycare we pay up front for their training to get level one, and then we take it off of their wages for a period of 6 months after that. That program's been really successful. We always get repayment. We don't have people doing it and then jumping board. So most of our staff are now level one ECEs. So no, not such a challenge. No, not really.
Okay.
Chris, you had something you
wanted
to
say?
Yeah, Mr. Christian, recognize you got a systemic problem here with future funding, and so if council agrees to give you the funding that you're asking for, have you had any discussions with the province about what that's going to look like in a year or two? Because without correcting your systemic problem, it'll be an ongoing request of council for a significant amount of money.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely, Chris. So I've been in pretty well constant conversation with the bureaucrats and the politicians around it. In terms of the bureaucrats, there's very little that they can do in terms of that they have to work with what they have to work with. But they are the funding relationship. So early childhood development is a provincial jurisdictionally is a provincial responsibility. But there's every 3 years there's a fund sharing thing with the feds, and they renegotiate how much the federal government is gonna contribute to the early childhood system. That's coming up for renewal, and so they are in talks with the feds now, and of course, they're always very, they're very guarded to overpromise, but they do say that they think that, that there will be, particularly with the posture of the feds, and particularly Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, very, very supportive of, at least in principle, early childhood education, so they believe that they will be able to get the feds to contribute more to the system, and that that should create a more healthy funding environment, is this the sense that I get from them. And again, and then on the political side, I mean, Ian Rankin, the new premier, he's talked about it a little bit. I think he's probably gonna be more willing to listen than the previous one. And as I said, our local MLA is, she's keen to be part of the fight to push for this. I think another big challenge is that we don't have a combined voice of people involved with nonprofit daycares in the province, because obviously there's strength in numbers, and this is largely misunderstood or issue. It doesn't get the airtime that it should. I have to think that's because all the people like me in the communities in rural Nova Scotia are so overworked by this that they're not super keen to take on another hour per week to engage in some sort of consortium. But I think that that's also part of the solution in the future, is having a common voice fighting for nonprofit daycares in rural Nova Scotia. Because the only place that daycares work right now is in the HRM. They run for profit. They have the economy of scale. They have 250 kids enrolled, and they're in a position where they can charge $60-$65 per day per child. So, but as I understand it, the vast majority of rural Nova Scotians finds themselves in a very, very similar situation. And look no further. Try to find a for-profit daycare outside of Halifax. You won't, because there's no, because it's a losing proposition right now. It's underfunded. It doesn't make sense. The model doesn't make sense. So we're doing everything we can, but I can't give you any assurances about what the province is going to do with regards to future funding, to be honest.
Other comments? Councillor Fancy.
Yes, Scott. A couple questions here. Because you had put forward some different problems right at the beginning, you know, with the sewer.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the water's always been, because you're limited to what you can have. When we look at this as the ask, with the others, are you capable of taking care of all that?
Sorry, what's your question?
With the ask that you are saying, mm-hmm. the couple asks you are bringing forward,
mm-hmm.
With the other situations, with the sewer, mm-hmm. with the water and other things that are going, are you capable of taking care of that, or are you just hoping on the other end? I just want to make sure this is the problem and this is the solution.
Yeah, so the totality, I think, of the problem, I think that's what you're asking, is we need $130,000 now in terms of to get over the finish line in terms of capital projects, and then we need to make up somewhere between a $50,000 and $70,000 operational shortfall for the next 24 to 36 months. I don't think it's realistic or fair to come and say, hey, council, we need 150 from you for now and 70 for the next 3 years. And so just in talking to some of your peers and in considering this in preparation for this, this is what we think is a realistic and a fair ask in terms of the local municipalities' part to play in this. We're going to need the other $80,000 for the capital project to come from somewhere else, private donors, most likely, and the other $40,000, $30,000 to $40,000 of operational deficits over the next, 24 to 36 months will have to come from other sources. We have a lot of moving pieces and a lot of irons in the fire, and so we do feel quite optimistic that those are going to come through. I'm not sure if that answers your question completely. We have a lot of irons in the fire, one of which is trying to get support from the municipality, I guess, to be part of the solution. I don't think it's fair that this all falls to the municipality to make up where the province is failing to fund the system. I think that's why I say it has to be an all hands on deck approach, so, but I do think that this contribution, this type of contribution from the municipality would, we've heard from private donors that it would get the ball rolling and would create a lot more goodwill amongst the private donor community to see the municipality get behind it. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Pretty much, can I just follow up? The other thing too is that when I look at the government, I don't want to say created this, because their intentions were good, but the backlash of it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because of it's helped with some of the people with low income, but it's hurt what you committees like, or what you're doing here in your organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So are they, so I guess they don't understand it is more of their creation of a problem. And the other thing is too, is like I always think of, like even with you talk about the hospital, and I talked about Dr. Doucette with the Hospital Foundation. Are they willing to be, I'd like to see who else is all
mm-hmm.
willing to say we need this, so
mm-hmm.
so they see this as a problem and willing to jump in too.
Yeah, the Hospital Foundation specifically, I'll agree with you. It is the province's responsibility to ensure that there's appropriate funding for young children and the development of young children in our communities. It is decidedly the province's responsibility, and they have failed in that, particularly since the addition of the pre-primary program, and also just the funding levels have been stagnant forever. The Southwest Nova hasn't had an uptick in terms of the funding that's available for nonprofit daycares in ever. Like it is horribly underfunded. With regards to the Hospital Foundation, I think they're beholden to the expectations of donors that the funds that go to the Hospital Foundation are directly used on the hospital itself. Our presentation to the Hospital Foundation some weeks ago was very well received. I've had a number of the trustees coming up to me and offering encouraging remarks. They are looking creatively in ways that they can be part of the solution in terms of looking for an opportunity to incentivize or subsidize childcare for and encourage healthcare professionals working at the hospital to bring their kids there, so to drive enrollment in that way. But it sounds like it's going to be challenging to actually get any money right now, urgently, any emergency funding from the Hospital Foundation, because they see it as difficult to reconcile given the mandate and expectation of their donors with regards to how that money is supposed to be, the stewardship of that money. But certainly, Alan, I'm not sure if all of you have had the opportunity to read the letter of support that he sent to the council around this issue. He's been incredible. He has been providing me with a ton of support and advice in helping me navigate this. And the Hospital Foundation continues to explore what role they can play in supporting us moving forward.
Okay, thank you.
Councilor Brown?
How does your fee model work compared to the older for-profit ones that were running in Queens County?
So I'm not familiar with the old for-profit model, but basically the province controls it.
Okay.
The province controls how much we can charge for the services that we provide. We can only increase it by 3% per annum, or else have to go through a process where we apply for an exceptional increase, which we did this year. We upped the parent fees from $28.50 to $32. There's another really challenging thing about COVID is that sat on a bureaucrat's desk in the province for over 9 months before that was actioned. And after we get that approval, then we need to provide some time, with two months, I think, of a heads up to parents about the fee increase. But we're now sitting at the high end of the regional approved average for per day childcare fees. But that's the tricky part, is the province controls both sides of the ledger, to be honest. They tell us how many staff per kid, what educational attainment our staffing complement have to have, what the standards are for food and for the environment, all of which I think is a good thing, because our kids matter, and a good, structured, evidence-based model that aligns to a standard should be in place. But the challenge is the funding doesn't match it.
Yeah.
And they tell us how much we can charge for the services we provide and how much they're willing to fund it. And as you see, it doesn't work. Bleeding money to the tune of $70,000 a year. It's ridiculous, is what it is.
Scott, they let you charge up to 32, is what they increased your rate of charge.
That's what we were able to get them to approve. We actually went in a little higher than that, but had to scale it back to get it through.
And am I correct in saying that they subsidize for low-income families at 35?
No. They subsidize to the rate that we charge for childcare.
Okay, because I thought you had said 35. So it's 25 units of 32. So they subsidize at the rate that you would pay.
My understanding of the subsidies are through Department of Community and Social Services, not Education and Early Childhood Development. It's needs based. It's a percentage based on the parent and family's ability to earn income, and then so a percentage of the bill that parent would have after 2 week period would be subsidized. So based on the need, they would say, you know, family X gets 80%, and so however much their child uses that. But it's all, the rates don't change. The rates are what we charge for the service, and the DCS subsidizes a proportion of it based on need of the family.
And then the parent or guardian would pay the difference. So
that's right.
If the guardian or parent was charged $27, then, or subsidized for $27,
right,
based upon their income, then the guardian or parent would pay the difference to 32.
That's right. We get paid the same amount per kid that's there, but whether it's DCS paying it or the parents paying it.
That's a pretty modest fee. Are you allowed to have a two-tiered system?
No.
So you can have, if you have two professional breadwinners that are making $180,000 a year, they still only have to pay 32?
That's correct. As part of this model, it's part of the principle of inclusivity, or it's a no, we are not able to have a two-tiered fee model.
But a non-licensed daycare?
Oh, for certain. Non-licensed daycares can do whatever they want. But if we were a non-licensed daycare, we wouldn't have DCS subsidizing us, and we wouldn't have $98,000 in provincial funding per annum. We would not be meeting the need in the community as an unlicensed daycare whatsoever.
Before I thank Scott for his presentation, any final comments? Councillor Charlton?
Yes, as a past board member for Queen's Daycare Association, I have a vast understanding of all the regulations and things, and like Scott had said, there's a lot of moving parts, but the subsidized part is the huge part for this community, because as we all learned many months ago, well, at least 40% of Queens County lives in poverty, and the amount of children that are in poverty is very high. So with the subsidized childcare model, there are many parents with low income, or that are low income, that are only paying a couple dollars a day, that are just scraping by as it is. So the fact that this organization is the only subsidized center with the financial restraints and things that are happening for the future, I just worry, what that would look like for those folks that are paying a couple dollars a day now, that are barely making ends meet, and they're, then what happens? Because you have a couple private childcare operators in the home that are at least $35 a day. There's no subsidization available. So, I wanted to touch on that because I think that's very important. Yes, huge economical impact to this community, but the vulnerable children are definitely what tugged at my heart as well. Thanks, Scott.
Scott, I thank you for your presentation. As you know, this is the time of year when council starts deliberating funds and monies for our next fiscal. It was refreshing to hear that you did receive that funds to keep you going to at least summer,
yeah,
which I believe the last time I was talking to you, that was questionable. So, like I said, it was a wonderful presentation. You certainly, I believe, made council realize the restrictions under which you have to live. All I can say is we will do our best one vote of seven, eight people. Deputy Mayor Muse sent his regrets today, so I thank you, and if we have any further questions, I know we will be in touch.
Great. All right, thanks everyone.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks.
Well, the regular council meeting, the council minutes